Welcome to Politics and Reality Radio. I'm Joshua Holland. This week, we're going to speak with Sean Richman. He's a labor organizer. He wrote a piece for the Washington Post this week about Janus versus AFSCME? a crucial Supreme Court case that will test the right's latest assault on unions, this time public sector unions. Then we'll speak with Luke Barnes from Think Progress about a pattern that he's seen of fringe right-wingers killing police officers. And he notes that the story sometimes does not make national headlines. Some of these killings have happened in rural areas and kind of went under the radar to some degree. Finally, we'll be joined by Sophia Resnick. She's an investigative reporter at Rewire News, and she's going to talk about a seemingly minor trespassing case that folks on both sides of the abortion debate are watching very closely. But first, you know, there was a story this week that really drove home the degree to which Trumpism is just a giant grift. It was The Intercept that reported that Jared Kushner's heavily indebted real estate firm, and I quote, made a direct pitch to Qatar's Minister of Finance in April 2017 in an attempt to secure investment in a critically distressed asset in the company's portfolio, end quote. That asset is the giant building in New York that's underwater, deeply indebted. So the Qataris said no to the deal, and just weeks later, Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, with Kushner's backing, quote, led a diplomatic assault that culminated in a blockade of Qatar. Kushner, according to The Intercept, undermined efforts by Secretary of State Rex Tillerson to bring an end to the standoff. So they went to the Qataris and asked for money, didn't get it, they were rebuffed. And then very shortly afterward, there was this blockade that the Trump regime supported and endorsed. Trump tweeted out a bunch of crazy tweets about how Qatar funded terrorism. So then this week, the Intercept report was followed up by NBC. They reported, and again I quote, that federal investigators are scrutinizing whether Jared Kushner's business discussions with foreigners during the presidential transition, so this is before they came into office, shaped White House policies in ways designed to either benefit or retaliate against those he spoke with. So this is the president's idiot son-in-law who has no qualifications. He's given this giant portfolio, fix the Middle East, you know, fix the opioid crisis, do this, do that. And he's up to his eyeballs in debt with this building. And he's going around from country to country and trying to get money out of them. And when they don't pony up, he's punishing them. This would be a gigantic scandal in any other administration. And with Trump, it kind of just blends into the fabric of all the corruption and ridiculousness. You probably heard the HUD Secretary Ben Carson had ordered a $31,000 dining set. That was a story that made headlines this week. It was big news. The piece that didn't get as much attention as I think it should is that there's this woman, Helen Foster. She was a senior HUD official, and she was, and I quote, demoted and replaced with a Donald Trump appointee for refusing to break the law by funding an expensive redecoration of Ben Carson's office. So this is according to The Guardian. The law says that the agency could spend up to $5,000 on renovations. She was told that $5,000 will, and I quote, not even buy a decent chair. And then she was demoted. And the real story here, again, according to The Guardian, is that the Department of Housing and Urban Development is facing $6.8 billion in budget cuts. That amounts to 14% of its total spending, and it will, quote, lead to reductions in programs aimed at poor and homeless Americans. So, at the same time as they're cutting the department's budget for the poor by 14%, Carson's trying to buy a $31,000 dining set. This is, by the way, part of $165,000 that they're spending on, quote, lounge furniture for their Washington headquarters. New York Times reported this week that Melania Trump has parted ways with an advisor after news about the advisor's firm reaping $26 million in payments to help plan President Trump's inauguration. So this woman, Stephanie Winston Wolkoff, who's been friends with Melania for a long time, the New York Times said that she has been working on a contract basis as an unpaid senior advisor to the office of the First Lady. But Wolkoff established this company only, quote, weeks before the inauguration and pulled in $26 million for helping plan the inauguration, which really kind of stretches the definition of unpaid advisor. Meanwhile, people are wondering how Melania, a kind of middling fashion model, secured a so-called Einstein visa that's usually, quote, reserved for people with extraordinary ability. Mary Jordan reports for the Washington Post that Melania's ability to secure her green card not only set her on the path to U.S. citizenship, but put her in the position to sponsor the legal residency of her parents. And she notes, that is, Jordan notes, that President Trump has proposed ending the sponsorship of relatives such as parents, slamming as chain migration the decades-long ability of U.S. citizens to assist relatives in obtaining legal residency. Oh, well. Oh, well. It's all one giant grift, folks. And on that note, stay tuned. We're going to take a quick break, and then we'll come right back. Welcome back. I'm Joshua Holland, and I learned something new this week. I'm of course familiar with right to rip off a union laws, which corporate America has dubbed right to work, as if anyone is being prevented from working by organized labor. And as you probably know, they bar unions from billing workers who get benefits negotiated by a union, who aren't dues-paying members for the costs of representing them. Just the direct costs of representing them, not costs of political action or anything else. And this is set up with in contracts with management, and it should be protected by the contract clause of the Constitution, but the courts have held that they're legal, and they've been a highly effective tool against organized labor. Now the Supreme Court is set to hear a case called Janus versus AFSCME, which would give the entire public sector the right to rip off a union. But I didn't know that this could come with some unintended consequences that the conservative business groups who push the litigation may not like. My next guest wrote about that angle this week in the Washington Post. Sean Richman is a union organizer. He's the author of Labor's Bill of Rights, which was a report published last summer by the Century Foundation. Sean, welcome to Politics and Reality Radio.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Before we get into your piece, let's talk a little bit about the background here. According to the latest data from BLS, only 6.5% of private sector workers belong to a union. Over a third of public sector workers are organized. So Republicans stole a Supreme Court seat. Here comes a case that could do to the public sector what they've managed to do to the private sector, to private sector unions. Do you know who's behind this case?
Specifically, everybody. I mean, it's the vast right-wing conspiracy, right? The folks that are pushing this are part of, you know, what we call the Koch-tipus, which is all these Koch brother-funded right-wing outfits, vaguely think-tanky. You got the National Right to Work Foundation. But, you know, they're all in cahoots. And the plan is it's as simple as a highly partisan effort to knock out the last bastion of union representation, which is the public sector unions, which have a much higher rate of unionization and are the pillars of the AFL-CIO, knock them out, try to knock out their source of funding, and in so doing, they're hoping to knock out a key source of the Democratic Party's get-out-the-vote operation. They understand better than Democratic politicians that unions are key to keeping fascists out of office.
This is a really important point. A recent study, it was published last few weeks by James Feigenbaum, Alexander Hertel Fernandez, and Vanessa Williamson, and they found that the Democratic Party's share of the vote declined by 3.5% in states that passed right to rip off a union laws, and that's more than the margin of victory that Dems have enjoyed in a number of states in recent elections. And I'd also just point listeners to a New York Times piece published 2 weeks ago behind a key anti-labor case, a web of conservative donors, which kind of goes through exactly what Sean was talking about. It is literally a vast right-wing conspiracy. We joke about that, but it's no joke in this case. How big of a threat does the Supreme Court, if they rule in favor of the plaintiffs, how big of a threat does that pose for the labor movement?
Here's the thing. I think unions are prepared for losing this case. And the unions that are most affected by it, SEIU, AFSCME, AFT-NEA, have been doing the necessary internal organizing in advance of getting everybody who is an agency fee payer currently to actively and consciously and voluntarily join the union. And, you know, they're focusing on one-on-one conversations in the workplace and all that. So it's not going to be, I don't think it's going to be a devastating hit right away. What it will do is more like what Right to Work does, which is it's more of this slow decline as new hires come into the workplace and you know, structures just get a bit flabby. The percentage of workers in a union-represented workplace declines over time. It's a mixed bag in that way. I don't think it's going to be this devastating hit and suddenly we're down to 3%, you know, unionization in this country by November. But it's very bad. It's very, very, very bad. And in particular, what's bad about it is, I think it just breaks the labor relations framework. In a very fundamental way that we should be talking more about and strategizing more about, because our very peculiar labor relations system in the United States is based on four components that really all go hand in hand. And that is exclusive representation of one union only if there's going to be a union in a workplace, agency fee to compensate the union for that service, no strike clauses, and a fairly wide degree of management's rights to operate, you know, sort of determine the operations of the plant. Those four things all go hand in hand. If you knock out one of them, the whole system can fall apart.
Now, when you say that they go hand in hand, that's not written down in policy anywhere. This is how it has developed over time, right?
Yeah, no, it's how it developed over time, but it's how it developed in a fairly quick way around the time of the New Deal and World War II. And in ways that I think not a lot of people appreciate. I don't think that the right wing appreciates it. I don't think that most union supporters really think about at a granular level of the different components of what makes up what a union is. We just sort of think of, well, that job has a union, this job doesn't, you know, and just a union is what a union is. But it's more complicated than that because, you know, our model is there's no other country that really does it this way, and this wasn't the way that the unions operated in our country's history. When it worked, this system that I'm describing, when it worked, and you know, when we had 35% union density, and even non-union firms would match the more substantial pay and benefits that unions were able to win. But these attacks on the system are creating a total system failure that does require us, I think, to rethink what a union should be or what modes of worker organizing and worker representation should be in a right-to-work America.
So you have basically, we talk about the three-legged stool. This is a four-legged chair. And again, Sean's talking about the exclusive nature of union representation, agency fees, no strike clauses written into contracts, and then the idea that management has the right to run its plants as it wants, this four-legged chair. Again, you write in the WAPO that when you knock one part out, as the Janus plaintiffs aim to do with agency fees, the whole system can fall apart, and quote, I'm quoting you, employers will not like the chaos that will bring. So let's talk about the chaos that will bring. What happened? What kind of issues arose before this four-legged chair developed in this country the way it has?
So when the National Labor Relations Act was passed, there's nothing in the act about elections and all the workers in a workplace having to vote, and only if a majority vote for a union can there be a union. That's not actually how the law was designed, and some of us would argue that the law today could operate differently if we press it to. What the law really said was, hey, if a group of workers say, you know, that they're a union, boss, you got to get out your calendar, you know, get some bargaining dates, you got to meet with them and bargain in good faith. You don't even have to come up with a contract. You have to bargain in good faith. And so what you had early on was unions bargaining for their members only. A key date in history, the day after the U.S. Supreme Court rules that the National Labor Relations Act is constitutional, John L. Lewis, president of the mine workers, sponsor of the Steel Workers Organizing Committee, gets in a room with the CEO of U.S. Steel, and after a couple of hours, they emerge with a three-page contract for SWOX members only. The sort of thing that is mind-boggling to sort of modern union negotiators, where you can't bargain on behalf of workers that haven't voted to represent you. Well, if it's a members-only contract, then members vote by deciding whether to join the union or not. And that was a much more common model. What evolved eventually, though, was the idea that, well, if there's going to be a union in a workplace, rather than have competing unions, which existed in places like the New York City hotel industry, which is I've studied and I find fascinating, if there's going to be a union, we want one union, because the employers wanted to deal with, you know, one representative who was going to mediate all of the disputes in the workplace and prioritize what's most important. And they wanted that at the end of that negotiation, it was a settled matter for the length of the contract, which these were typically 1 to 2 year contracts at the time. But you know what? That's it. That's the wage. You know, that's how we're going to handle, you know, how we assign schedules. You know, those are the benefits, and we're done talking about this for the next 2 years. That's labor peace, you know, and there's not going to be a strike, you know, during the course of that bargaining. And, you know, for those first couple of contracts in the 30s and even into the 40s, you know, most workers where there was a union were joining the union because the contracts were pretty good, right? I mean, we're talking about the Great Depression here. It wasn't, you know, basically anything was an improvement at that point, you know. So a nickel increase in your wage is like, that's terrific. I'm sticking with the union, and people were joining. What happens, though, is in World War II, the unions all commit not to strike for the duration of the war in order to help the war effort, particularly in defense production. And they're reported for that by a federal wage freeze in order to sort of deal with inflation. And what happens then is workers who are suddenly not getting wage increases, but the price of milk is going up. I mean, inflation still continues to pace. So they're feeling the squeeze, also find themselves in a position where if they strike, they will be fired because of the no strike clause in the contract. And you know, and these clauses basically say, you know, if you strike during the terms of this deal, you can be fired, and it's not grievable. And so what a lot of workers did in protest is they simply quit the unions. You know, some of them quit so that they could engage in wildcat strikes so that the no strike clause wouldn't apply to them. Some of them just quit to, you know, get their money back or just to show, you know, just to vent their frustration at the situation. And the situation got so bad that, you know, a lot of union leaders started considering dropping their pledge to not strike during World War II. And so federal mediators started to insert what was then called a maintenance of membership clause, which was basically like, okay, if the contract was signed on March 2nd, then everybody who's a union member on March 2nd has to remain a union member for the year or two that this contract is going to last. So it basically created these like these open window periods around contract expiration when members could drop their membership. But otherwise, it guaranteed the unions a stable source of membership and dues revenue so that they could, you know, do these sort of, you know, do these sort of necessary but unpleasant acts of compromise in order to keep keep defense operations, keep the operations moving. And that evolved into our modern union shop and agency fee. So at its very at the dawn of this framework, that was the trade-off. No strike equals agency fee. So again, if you start poking at agency fee, the whole thing can collapse, particularly if unions decide to abandon exclusive representation in response to half the country going right to work.
So, the short version is that they bought labor peace by assuring that the unions would have enough revenues to function and to represent their members. So, now we're talking
about... I don't want to make it sound like a negative thing, right? Sometimes concessions are genuinely, you know, necessary, right? Like if you're fighting the Nazis, you need to keep the assembly line moving, right? And even in more modern terms, you know, when Chrysler, you know, periodically goes bankrupt, you know, it's necessary to take some concessions in order to keep your job so that the company doesn't go totally out of business, right? But those are unpopular actions, and those kinds of decisions are impossible for a union to do if they'll be rewarded with workers quitting and you know, their entire revenue stream dropping out. So it sort of forces unions to be a bit more responsible, or at least creates the space where they can be more responsible.
And this speaks to the risk that you outline in the piece, the potential unintended consequences of kicking one of those legs out from this four-legged chair, this four-legged stool, whatever. I keep mangling that metaphor, but which is, you write that, you know, what we're going to see is that, what we're likely to see is that unions will decide that if they're going to get ripped off with the free rider problem anyway, then they're just going to withdraw from some of these spaces, and that's going to leave a void that will be filled. And you write first by conservative, like, pseudo unions, and then by more radical, or, and you write, quote, at least crankier, progressive unions. Tell us, we only have a minute left. Tell us a little bit about what you see as the potential future here.
So, we'll see, right? I mean, it could be a model of multiple unions competing within a workplace, and competing on various, you know, in different ways. You know, some unions might see a value to being the responsible union that can take the best deal and then go out there and convince workers to join them because they can take the best deal. If you have multiple competing unions, though, the union that doesn't take a deal, I think, has more of an organizational incentive to disparage that deal and agitate for, we could do better and let's not give up and let's keep fighting for what that other union didn't win in this deal. It sounds like a bit of like a labor relations sci-fi fantasy spec script, but this is how unions operated in America before this framework was developed around World War II.
So this is the thing. The basic point is that management has undertaken this decades-long war on working people, on organized labor, and here they may be opening up kind of a Pandora's box where they end up with a more radical labor movement in response to disempowering these large institutional, somewhat more cautious unions. This is something that, you know, be careful what you wish for.
Or crankier or messier, right? Like, it's not like there are socialist unions waiting in the wings that are going to spring up. It's more that, you know, if unions cede exclusive representation, somebody else is going to fill that void. And you know, there's a lot of things about, at every workplace, there's a lot of things that people don't like about the day-to-day work rules, about, you know, if there is a union, about their contract. And this just creates spaces for people to break away and say, we're not satisfied and we're going to keep fighting for something different.
Folks, Sean's piece, you can read it at WashingtonPost.com. It's titled, If the Supreme Court Rules Against Unions, Conservatives Won't Like What Happens Next. Sean Richmond, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today. I really do appreciate it.
All right. Thank you for having me.
Folks, stay tuned. We're going to take a quick break and then talk about far-right extremism and violence against police officers. Stay tuned.
Getting high. I get high. From KC to H down to Nathan Southside. Now we worldwide. Watch me hot side. Fat pet, blowing killer, can't be denied. Thugs, oh yeah, we got love. Blowing we flow on and that bug. Wanna be a baller. Shot caller, 20 inch blades on the Impala. Caller, get laid tonight. Switch tight, got spray, but I ain't hit the highway. Making money to fly away. But it's got to be a better way. A better way, a better way, yeah.
See, back down south, rolling bins on blocks. Most really I got shining with shortstop. And that's for real. So tell me how you feel. To make $1 million on my first record deal. So I stop putting up your mother deal. Really, really don't give a f. I ain't drinking on no beer. When I sip, when I ride. Chunk here for life, baby, it's outside. We on a mission, expedition navigators. That's how we be riding. Alligator suitcases, putting it in your faces. And that's for real. Shining harder than the grill. It's the player look wheel. Down with the too low. Youngster be a thug. So the word, I'm down with more thugs. More thugs in the pound. You know it's going down. Represent that H-Town. I touch around my
soul. Wanna be a baller. Shot caller. 20 inch blades on the Impala. Caller, get laid tonight. Switch tight, got spray, but I not hit the highway. Making money to fly away. But it's got to be a better way.
And we're back. I'm still Joshua Holland. And I'm joined now by Luke Barnes. Luke is a reporter with Think Progress, and he wrote a piece this week that caught my eye. It's titled, Far-Right Extremists Are Quietly Murdering Police Officers. Whoa. And you can check it out at thinkprogress.org. Luke, welcome to Politics and Reality Radio.
Thanks for having me on. Appreciate it.
Thanks for taking the time. So you crunched some numbers on police killings and came up with a pretty alarming conclusion. What is going on here?
Well, basically, I've been aware that there have been a couple of like kind of high profile cases of far right extremists killing police officers over the last 10 years, but I hadn't seen any kind of full data on it. So I crunched the numbers over the last 10 years and it came up with an extremely high number, which is 33, including four corrections officers. But was occurring all over the U.S. and it seemed to be kind of concentrated in areas which don't necessarily get as much media attention kind of outside the main cities. I mean, if you look at the map of the killings, there are lots in kind of the South, rural West, up in like Idaho and Montana and Iowa and places like that. And the thing with this number is as well that when I was talking to experts in the field, I kind of was, you know, chatting to them about the number and had a conservative estimate of it, of that, if that makes sense, because there were other cases where there was kind of like a bit of a far right affiliation, but it was a bit weak. Like there was a shooting in Colorado on New Year's Eve 2017. This guy, Matthew Real, killed a sheriff's deputy near Denver, and Real had a lot of kind of like alt-right memes and that sort of stuff on his Facebook page. So that kind of perhaps indicated some affiliation, but it wasn't completely clear. So the overall point I'm making here is that while this number is shocking, there's the potential for it to be actually much higher.
And just for listeners who are thinking, well, you know, this seems anecdotal, et cetera, et cetera, I just want to point out that the Rand Corporation also did a study that found that right-wing fringe extremists were responsible for more terror attacks than Islamic extremists. There was a survey of law enforcement agencies conducted by the Police Executive Research Forum and the Triangle Center on Terrorism and Homeland Security. It found that police rate anti-government extremists as a greater threat than reactionary Islamists. There was a Department of Homeland Security report about sovereign citizens. They're kind of fringe anti-governmentalists. They had mm-hmm. been responsible for 24 violent attacks in the four-year period yeah. between 2010 and 2014. So this is not just a article that came out this week. This is a real problem that we don't talk about yeah. often enough. Let me ask you this.
Yeah, absolutely.
You write those self-radicalized lone wolf style attacks often seen in modern extremism can make it difficult to differentiate between attacks where individuals are following a particular ideology versus those where an individual may show some clues of extremist sympathies and may have been driven by other motivating factors. How do we square that kind of nuanced view of what are rather unstable people with the idea that these are attacks that we can credit with the far right?
Well, that's a very good question, especially, you know, if you look at people like kind of on a broader level, people like Dylann Roof, for instance, who, you know, shot up that church in South Carolina, like he was kind of self-radicalized. But he obviously fed into the father far-right terrorist ecosystem. I think in response to your original question, though, like a good number of these cases, it's kind of like the evidence is pretty clear. Like with, for instance, you know, the corrections officers I included, for instance, they are all like directly tied to white supremacist prison gangs. And you can kind of, you know, if you look up the photos of some of the perpetrators, they have tattoos, like neo-Nazi tattoos all over them. So that, those links are pretty clear. And like with the case in Pittsburgh back in 2009, where one Richard Poplawski, he shot three Pittsburgh police officers. He ambushed them with an AK-47, killed three of them. And he had been visiting Stormfront, which is a neo-Nazi website, quite frequently. And there were like backlogs of his chats on there. So there is kind of, it's difficult to differentiate them sometimes and to kind of to monitor them as well. But I think there's such a an emphasis on kind of Islamic terrorism in this country, which is, you know, obviously a threat. But then you have cases like what happened in Three Forks, Montana, where Lloyd Barris and his son killed a deputy up there. Now, Lloyd Barris had previously been in prison for getting in a standoff in California with cops out there, and he actually managed to shoot down a California Highway Patrol helicopter. No one was injured in it, but it's still like, yeah, that's if someone with, you know, Islamic extremist sympathies had done that, they'd be on every radar of every law enforcement agency in the U.S. and the FBI, the Department for Homeland Security would know where they were, you know, who they were associated with, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But somehow this guy, Lloyd Barris, managed to slip off the radar despite doing 15 years in prison. And I think, you know, it comes back to the point that you were making earlier, that actually, you know, this is a consistent threat. And people like Daryl Johnson, who's a former Homeland Security expert analyst who's done a lot of work on this, they've been warning about it they've been talking about it for a long time. And but the current administration doesn't really seem to want to take it seriously.
I mean, that's a really important point. The Trump administration has deprioritized, consistently deprioritized efforts to contain violent right-wing extremism. And that's something that I think is really troubling. You mentioned that a decent number of these attacks kind of took place in rural areas and didn't get the same kind of mainstream coverage as would be the case, obviously, if a Muslim extremist killed a cop in some rural area. Were all of the shooters in your sample white?
Yes, I believe they were. They were, actually. That's a good question. They were. There were some. I talk about some black nationalist extremists who were responsible for other attacks, but that's a much, much smaller slice of the pie than the white far-right extremists you see in all these attacks. I think there was one example where the shooter was half Latino, I believe, in Anahuac in Texas. But that's it. The rest of them were white.
I spoke to a professor who studies political violence, Nathan Calmo, and he said that violence, political violence, that within the mainstream, if you look at like mainstream conservatives, mainstream liberals, it's very rare that people engage in political violence in this country. And conservatives, mainstream conservatives, are no more likely than mainstream liberals or leftists to become violent. But what it is that political violence is typically seen among people who are outside of the system, who don't believe that the system can be managed through nonviolent means at the ballot box,
exactly.
For example. Let me ask you this, and it calls for some speculation. Do you think that there's a connection between the kind of mainstreaming of the conspiratorial Alex Jones kind of conservatism that says that, you know, there are the deep state, these forces that are kind of unseen, pulling the strings behind the scenes, George Soros paying protesters, that there's this alternative universe that we can't access, we can't really fight it at the ballot box. Do you think that that ties into the fact that there is so much more far-right violence than far-left violence?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that you've hit the nail on the head there. I mean, I want to offer the usual disclaimer in that, you know, just because you have, you know, conservative viewpoints, or you're a gun owner, or you have anti, you know, libertarian viewpoints and stuff like that, it doesn't make you someone who's going to go out and ambush a police officer and kill them. However, there is that link between, as you said, the kind of conspiratorial Alex Jones view of the world and view of America, and these far-right, extremists who are killing cops. You know, a lot of them believe that the police represent the kind of, they're the foot soldiers of the deep state, and that this, you know, the conspiracy is right around the corner from completing, being enacted, that, you know, we'll have this new world order and all our guns will be taken away, and, you know, the United Nations will take over America. That sort of like paranoid mindset is a real linking factor in a lot of these shootings. And a lot, as Darrell Johnson told me, you know, a lot of these guys kind of they look for an excuse to get in combat or in conflict with police officers. They look for a reason or a kind of moment in which they can think, well, you know, this is clearly an example of, you know, the law enforcement moving in on my, you know, constitutional freedoms or my freedoms as a sovereign citizen, et cetera, et cetera. And I need to defend myself and I need to kind of make a stand. And, you know, that's sort of the language that you're talking about of, like, you know, we're outside the mainstream and, you know, no, there's no political solution to this, is also very, very present in the kind of white nationalist, KKK neo-Nazi sphere of the far right. You know, that's basically what they, that's their frame of thinking. I mean, if you look at I've written about some of the literature which they are kind of inspired by, books like The Turner Diaries or Siege. And these books all make the point that, you know, you can't have, actual political discourse in this country, because the political discourse is corrupt, and because the political system is run by, you know, the deep state, which often is kind of just a veil for antisemitism. basically that's what it all comes down to. I think you're absolutely right to make that connection between this kind of fringe, not really fringe anymore, unfortunately, but this kind of paranoid conspiratorial talk that Alex Jones and, you know, Jack Posobiec and other people on the far right engage in. And, you know, it kind of trickles down to these acts of violence that we see.
And I would just add to that the gun lobby's consistent narrative that firearms are the bulwark against tyranny, and this idea, you know, this Dawn idea that you can hold off government tyranny.
That's completely, again, you've phrased it completely accurately there, and that's something that really kind of, I mean, I'm half American, half English, I understand that, you know, that the Second Amendment has a place in American society, which, you know, the outside world may not quite comprehend, but it really, really kind of astounds me that, you know, these people, all they want to do in terms of, when they want to talk in terms of, like, you know, preserving the Constitution, and, you know, defending liberty. All they're ever talking about is firearms. All they're ever talking about is, like, you know, we need to keep our AR-15s because that's going to be the bulwark against tyranny. Well, yeah, fine, but what about, like, education and, you know, keeping abreast of what's happening in the conflict of interest between, you know, business and politics and stuff like that? Because, you know, this idea that quote-unquote tyranny is going to come to the U.S., with like these jackbooted New World Order thugs going down the street is a pretty old school view of tyranny. If you look at places like Turkey, or if you look at places like the Philippines or Russia now, you'll see that, you know, authoritarianism.
Yeah,
exactly. It's a very, very different system now. So this idea that the only thing keeping us safe is, you know, a bunch of guys with AR-15s in Montana or whatever is old school thinking, and it's not accurate now anymore, in my opinion.
Well, the framers of the Constitution gave us a bulwark against tyranny, and it wasn't the Second Amendment; it was the separation of powers.
Yeah, exactly.
So, I mean, you know, we should just keep in mind that this rhetoric we see from the NRA and a lot of conservative politicians, it has real world consequences, and that's what Luke's piece is really about. It's called "Far Right Extremists Are Quietly Murdering Police Officers." Let me also give a shout out to myself. I wrote a piece back in last June called "Why Does the Far Right Hold a Near Monopoly on Political Violence?" And in that, there's Nathan Calmo's comments as well. Luke, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to join us. I believe we're out of time.
Thanks for taking the time to talk to me. I appreciate it.
Thank you. I really do appreciate it. Folks, stay tuned. We're going to take a quick break and then talk about the assault on abortion rights. Stay tuned. I'm still Joshua Holland, and I'm happy to welcome Sophia Resnick to the show. Sophia is an investigative reporter for Rewire News, and she wrote a piece this week titled "Why a Trespassing Trial This March Has Caught the Attention of Activists on Both Sides of the Abortion Movement." Listeners can check that out at rewire.com. Sophia, welcome to Politics and Reality Radio.
Hi there. Thank you so much for having me. And just one quick note, it's rewire.news.
Rewire.news. Okay, sorry about that. Rewire.news.
No,
I will perhaps give away my age when I tell you that during the 1980s, the late 80s, there was an outfit called Operation Rescue, which would like physically attack abortion clinics. And I remember taking a very long bus ride from New York City to Buffalo to do clinic defense, and we were indeed attacked by people who claimed to be pro-life, physically attacked, and we fought back. It was It was all very punk rock. Anyway, that group has been overtaken by other radical elements of the forced childbirth movement. And I want to begin with some background. Last fall, your colleague Jessica Mason Plico, who's been on the show in the past, wrote a piece about how anti-choice protesters were all but daring Attorney General Jeff Sessions to enforce the FACE Act. Sophia, what is the FACE Act? How did it come to be, and why is this important?
So the FACE Act is the Freedom of Access to Clinic Entrances Act. It was enacted in 1994 in response to some of the tactics that you were referring to. This movement called Operation Rescue, which is also the name of the organization, but also the name of the movement, were inciting all kinds of violent, but also just disruptive tactics to prevent people from physically having abortions. So these involved pervasive blockades, in some cases, hundreds of people using their bodies to block someone from going into an abortion clinic. They would chain themselves to fences. They would glue locks of the doors of clinics. In some cases, they would destroy property. And then it eventually escalated to some people, forgetting this idea that they were going to try to be nonviolent and try to be peaceful in the vein of the 1960s civil rights movement. And some people escalated to bombing clinics, or at least threatening to bomb clinics. And then in a few horrifying cases, they murdered abortion providers and clinic staff.
So that was the impetus for passing the law, right? And what does the law actually say?
Exactly. That was the impetus. And so in 1994, under Bill Clinton, Congress finally passed this law that said it was a federal crime to use force or threat of force or to intimidate anyone who tries to provide reproductive health services or anyone who tries to access reproductive health services. And by the way, this law also applied to religious houses as well.
And how has it been enforced or not enforced?
Yeah, it, ironically or not, it kind of depends on which administration is in power.
Shocker.
Right. How often and how frequently it's enforced. Under Democratic administrations, there have been more criminal lawsuits brought by the DOJ against people who have allegedly violated the FACE Act, but it comes in different forms. The FACE Act allows for the DOJ to bring a criminal lawsuit against a person or group of people, but it also allows for civil remedies. So an individual clinic can bring a civil lawsuit under the FACE Act against parties, and so can state attorneys general. And yeah, it's kind of a tricky one to prosecute, because oftentimes judges and juries will differently interpret the meaning of some of these words. So, for instance, what does it mean to intimidate someone, or even in some cases, what does it mean to threaten someone? So it's a difficult one to prosecute. But believe it or not, the Trump administration has already brought one. Has brought a FACE lawsuit against a party, not related to the story I wrote, though.
The goal of clinic protesters, of course, is ultimately intimidation. It can be very, very, very nasty. So let's fast forward to this week. You wrote about a simple trespassing trial. I believe the charges are all misdemeanors. That has people on both sides of the issue paying close attention. What's the story here?
Yeah, so in the vein of what we were talking about, the rescue movement, Operation Rescue, last fall there was a new movement that cropped up called the Red Rose Rescues. And this, a small group of activists, about a dozen activists around the country, have been coordinating these, what they call Red Rose Rescues. And just to back up a sec, the reason they called it the Operation Rescue was so that they could, quote, rescue babies, pre-born babies, as they call them, about to be aborted. So the Red Rose Rescues involve people going into clinics And so they're trespassing. They go into clinics. They refuse to leave. They hand roses to people who are waiting to have abortions, or in some cases just going to, you know, get their birth control filled or to get a pap smear. They hand them roses. They tell them, they beg them not to have abortions. They pray loudly. They make a whole commotion. And then they refuse to leave until police arrive. And when police arrive, they go limp. So, you know, in these cases, there might be like four police officers who have to carry each individual out. And they've done this twice at three separate occasions each time, creating kind of a chaotic, disruptive scene each time.
Now, you write, and I quote, "All of the arrested activists were released on their own recognizance, and many returned to the same clinics that very day, that very same day, and resumed picketing outside." So that makes it clear that this is an intentionally provocative action. You also write, and I quote, "The Red Rose rescuers are tight-lipped about their specific plans going forward, but it is clear that these actions have been the result of intense planning and coordination." What do you think their end game is?
Well, I mean, I think their end game is to increase these actions, to kind of rekindle the movement, because the rescue movement had become pervasive, where a lot of people were willing to do this, to resist arrest, and to be, because they didn't have much to lose until it became a federal crime. And then people gave up the rescue movement because they were like, well, we don't, you know, this is, there's too much at stake now. And the Red Rose Rescues have argued that what they're doing now does not violate the FACE Act, because they say, okay, this is not like the old rescue movement. We're not blocking the doors. People can still get in. They can still go to the clinic. The clinic can resume their business just as normal. We're just here in protest. Obviously, the other side argues something totally different. So yeah, I think their endgame is just to create a movement that's as disruptive as it used to be.
So you don't think that they're trying to challenge the constitutionality of the FACE Act?
I do think they are in part, but yeah, I think that's definitely part of it. And as I write in the story, you know, they want to get arrested and they want to go to court. Like in some cases, you know, this could be waived away easily. They could take little plea deals and just have to you know, accept some probation and agree not to go back to the clinic within a few, you know, a certain time frame. But instead, they want to go to court and they want to make an argument that says, we had to do this because of abortion. And they want to go into court and testify about abortion. And yeah, I'm sure that their end game really, as you say, in part, is to have this be a FACE case and a highly publicized one where they talk about, you know, how abortion is murder and why what they're doing is justified. And hopefully, maybe, to change what it means to violate the FACE Act.
And in your piece, you write about how they use these court dates to grandstand about abortion, et cetera, and they try to make a necessity defense, saying that they're stopping so-called baby killing, which is the most ridiculous, extreme rhetoric, and yet we find it acceptable in our everyday discourse. This is a bugaboo of mine, baby killing. The idea that you can accuse people who disagree with you on a policy issue of infanticide and get away with it is outrageous, and I talk about this sometimes. It's a pet peeve. Anyway, Sophia, I believe we are out of time. I want to thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me.
Thank you very much. It was great to be here.
Folks, check out Sophia's piece. It's called "Why a Trespassing Trial This March Has Caught the Attention of Activists on Both Sides of the Abortion Movement." And listeners can check it out at rewire.news, not .com. I'd also like to thank Sean Richman and Luke Barnes. You can follow me on Twitter at Joshua Hall. You can subscribe to the show at iTunes or Podbean or SoundCloud or wherever else you get your podcasts. You can send an angry email to politicsandreality@gmail.com. I'd like to thank the good folks at Crooks and Liars at Hullabaloo and Smirking Chimp for hosting the show at their respective joints. And of course, I would like to thank you fine people for tuning in. Have a terrific week.
me this away, 'cause I'll be back on my feet someday.